Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show.
Hello,
I'm Lila.
And Leo. Yeah.
All kinds of news tonight. Some good, some not so good.
Yeah, really. You know what's fascinating is, there's a lot of fascinating things going on here, but let me start the show off with a quote from a very brilliant man, Nikola Tesla. And he said, "Antisocial behavior is a trait of intelligence in a world full of conformists." There you go, folks. And, well, let's see, I guess so much interesting stuff here. My goodness. Almost impossible. Barack Obama stated in March 31st, 2008, before he was elected, that the biggest problems that we're facing right now have to do with George Bush trying to bring more and more power into the executive branch and not go through Congress at all. And that's what I intend to reverse when I'm president of the United States of America. Isn't that a farce?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's Senator Barack Obama, March 31st, 2008, said that. You know, what a farce. What a freaking farce. Unbelievable. But anyway, well, what can I tell you, huh? Hey, let's go on from here. God, I got so much stuff. This is sent to me by Jim Hightower.
What did he say?
He said, "Why isn't this man in jail?" His name is Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase.
Oh, yeah.
He said, "Assume that you ran a business that was founded guilty of bribery, forgery, perjury, defrauding homeowners, fleecing investors, swindling customers, cheating credit card holders, violating U.S. trade laws, and bilking American soldiers. Can you even imagine the punishment you'd get?" Huh? Well, that Jamie Dimon got nothing.
Nope.
That's right. President of the CEO is J.P. Morgan Chase. Good Lord, man. Oh, this is in really kind of interesting. Another banker, suicide, shoots himself 8 times with a nail gun.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Hey, who the hell would commit suicide by shooting himself 8 times with a nail gun? Yeah. Who? I mean, who's stupid enough to do that? You know, see, this is what's happening is you have a rash of bankers killing themselves, or supposedly killing themselves, recently. And I think this guy's like the 5th or 6th one in the last couple months. Another banker suicide shoots himself 8 times with a nail gun. Richard Talley, 57, founder of American Title Services in Centennial, Colorado, was found dead in his home on Tuesday. Talley once claimed to be a member of the 1980 U.S. swim team. U.S. Swimming refuted this on Thursday. A CEO has committed suicide by shooting himself multiple times with a nail gun, a coroner reported on Friday. Richard Talley, 57, founder of American Title and Central Colorado Title
Founder of American
Central
Title
Sentinel, Colorado, was found dead in his home. His company was being investigated by state insurance regulators at the time of Mr. Talley's suicide. All right. Now, a family member found the 57-year-old dead in his garage, the Denver Post reported. Mr. Talley had been married to his wife, Cheryl, since 1989. He moved to Colorado from Chicago, where he was a regional finance officer for Drexel Berman. Cheryl serves as a company director of marketing for the title company, which was founded in 2000. The couple has two children. He attended the University of Miami and Northwestern University Kellogg Graduate School of Management. Blah, blah, blah. It's just a resume of that. But what's weird, Mr. Daly had formed a number of companies, some of which closed down, including American Escrow, Clear Title, Clear Creek Financial Holdings, Swift Basin, Sumar, American Real Estate Service, and American Alliance for Real Estate Professionals. The guy was obviously a fraud. But his funeral will be held on Saturday in the Sentinel. Unbelievable. But the amazing,
what's the point of all that?
The point is that who the hell, I mean, is this, the article didn't clarify, but the thing was is that these bankers, there's probably been five or six of them in the last few months that have killed themselves.
Oh, really?
By weird ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
A nail gun's an extremely painful way of...
Well, yeah, who the hell was... And I mean, all you got to do is put one through your head, and chances are you'll die. But, you know, this guy hit himself eight times? I don't think so. All right?
I don't think so either.
I don't think so. It doesn't make any sense. You know,
somebody did.
Yeah, obviously. He was murdered. And but the coroner is saying it's
a
suicide by nail.
I don't think so. That.
But this goes along with so many of the other issues that they had. So many other articles that there have been about these guys in the last maybe three or four months.
Really?
Five different banker suicides, yeah. Right.
I have an article on taxes and the folly of arming Israel. We Americans have a funny notion about foreign aid. Recent polls show that on average we believe 28% of the federal budget is eaten up by it, and that in times of austerity, this gigantic bite of budget should be cut back to 10%. In actual fact, barely 1% of the federal budget goes to foreign aid of any kind. In this case, however, truth is at least as strange as fiction. Consider that the top recipient of U.S. foreign aid over the past three decades isn't some impoverished lawn filled with starving kids, but a wealthy nation with a per-head gross domestic product on par with the European Union average, and higher than that of Italy, Spain, or South Korea. Consider also that this top recipient of such aid, nearly all of its military since 2008, has been engaged in what looks like a 19th century style colonization project. In the late 1940s, our beneficiary expelled some 700,000 indigenous people from the land it was claiming. In 1967, our client seized some contiguous pieces of real estate, and ever since has been colonizing these territories with nearly 650,000 of its own people. It has divided the conquered lands with myriad of checkpoints and roads accessible only to the colonizers, and is building a 440-mile wall around and cutting into the conquered territory, creating a geography of control that violates international law.
I think you know who that country is by now, but if you don't, we will continue. Maybe.
I hope so. I don't know how that happened. Okay.
I don't need that error there, darling.
Ethnic cleansing is a harsh term, but after the situation in which people are driven out of their homes and lands because they are not of the right tribe. Though many will balk at leveling this charge against Israel, for that country is, of course, the top recipient of American aid and especially military largesse, who would hesitate to use the term if in a mirror image world all of this were being inflicted on Israeli Jews? Arming and bankrolling a wealthy nation acting in this way may on its face seem like a terrible policy. Yet American aid has been flowing to Israel in even greater quantities. Over the past 60 years, in fact, Israel has absorbed close to $250 billion in such aid. Last year alone, Washington sent some $3.1 billion in military aid, supplemented by allocations for collaborative military research and joint training exercise. Overall, the United States covers nearly one quarter of Israel's defense budget, from tear gas canisters to F-16 fighter jets. In their 2008-2009 assault on Gaza, the Israeli Defense Forces made use of M-92s and M-84 dumb bombs. Paveway 2 and JDM guided smart bombs, AH-64 Apache attack helicopters equipped with AGM-114 Hellfire guided missiles, M-141 bunker defeat munitions, and special weapons like M825A1 and 155mm white phosphorus munitions. All supplied is American foreign aid. Uniquely among Washington's aid recipients, Israel is also permitted to spend 25% of the military funding from Washington on weapons made by its own weapon industry. Why is Washington doing this? The most common answer is the simplest. Israel is Washington's ally. But the United States has dozens of allies around the world, none of which is subsidized in anything like this fashion by the American taxpayer dollar, as there is no formal treaty alliance between the two nations. And given the lopsided nature of the costs and benefits of this relationship, a far more accurate term for Israel's ties to Washington might be client state. And not a particularly loyal client either. If massive military aid is supposed to give Washington leverage over Israel, as it normally does in a client-state relationship, it is difficult to detect. In case you haven't noticed, rare is the American diplomatic visit to Israel that is not greeted with an in-your-face announcement of intensified colonization of Palestinian territory, euphemistically called settlement expansion.
Oh.
Interesting, huh?
That's about a 5-page article.
Yeah. Well, let me just...
I don't think you want to go all that distance, but...
No. It's a long article.
But, you know, it's true. I mean,
if you want to go to this, you can go to Alternet, The Folly of Arming Israel, Why It Doesn't Make Sense to Arm Israel, and Why No One Ever Discusses the Subject. This is by Chase Madar and, let's see.
All right. No, it doesn't matter. Just stop doing it. Stop funding Israel. Let's go to this one. Legalizing Oppression by Chris Hedges. I don't know if anybody's aware of, I don't know how many people are aware of Lynn Stewart, but she was arrested. The lynching in this, she was arrested back in 06, yeah, and for trying to be a lawyer to prisoners and being held in indefinite detention in Guantanamo.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't remember that. What happened to her?
Well, the lynching and disbarring of civil rights lawyer Lynn Stewart, who, because she has terminal cancer, was recently released from prison after serving 4 years of a 10-year sentence, is a window into the collapse of the American legal system. Stewart, who has stood up to state power for more than 3 decades in order to give a voice to those whom authorities seek to crush, who has spent her life defending the poor and the marginalized, who left in court when one of her clients was barred from presenting a credible defense, is everything a lawyer should be in an open society. But we no longer live in an open society, and the persecution of Stewart is the persecution of us all. Now, this is by Chris Hedges.
Wow.
Stewart, 74, is living with her husband in her son's house in New York City after being released from a Texas prison a month ago. Because she is disbarred, she cannot perform any legal work, can't even work in a law office. She said softly last week when I interviewed her in the Brooklyn home, I missed it so terribly. I like it. I liked it. I like the work.
Her career as one of the country's most renowned civil rights lawyers coincided with the fall of our legal system. She said when she started practicing law in the 1970s, it was a golden era in which a series of legal decisions, including rulings affecting police lineups and what information and evidence the government had to turn over to defendants on trial, created a chance for a fair defense. But these legal advances reversed in a string of court decisions that, especially after 9/11, made the state omnipotent. As citizens were stripped of power, she said, a death of the spirit of the bar occurred. Lawyers gave up, she said. They no longer saw defending people accused of a crime as a calling, something that you did because you were answering a higher voice. I don't want to make anything a kind of a religious thing. It wasn't that. But, you know, you defended people because they were up against the mightiest organism in the universe, the government of the United States. Whether they were state or federal, she said Thursday evening, as we sat with her husband, Ralph Pointer, at her son's dining room table. Stewart, working with former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark and lawyer Abdin Jabara in 1995, was the lead trial counsel for Omar Abdel Rahman, an Egyptian Muslim known as the Blind Sheikh, who was convicted in October of that year for alleged involvement in the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. He received life in prison plus 65 years, a sentence Stewart called outlandish. She said Abdul Rahman was put on trial not for any crimes he committed, but because the Egyptian government of Hosni Mubarak, as well as Washington, was frightened of his influence over the Egyptian masses. The United States, along with Egypt, wanted to take him off the scene and get him put away where he could no longer exert the influence that he had. This cleric, now 75 and in poor health, is imprisoned in the medical wing of the Butner Federal Complex in North Carolina. The court, through numerous rulings, refused to let Stewart mount her defense, ensuring that the government prosecution would not be challenged. The proceedings were a tawdry show trial, a harbinger of the many judicial assaults against Muslims in the United States after the events of September 11, 2001. I was based in Egypt at the time of the trial as the Middle East Bureau Chief for the New York Times. I remember being stunned at the repeated mendacity of government prosecutors who blamed Abdul Rahman for terrorist acts he had, in fact, publicly denounced. The prosecutors, for example, accused him of orchestrating the killing of 62 people in 1997 in Luxor, Egypt, although the Sheikh at the time condemned the attack and had no connection with the Egyptian group that carried out the massacre. When the guilty verdict was read, Stewart burst into tears, the only time I ever cried in the courtroom. Stewart continued to visit the Sheikh after the sentencing. 3 years after the trial, the government severely curtailed his ability to communicate with the outside world, even through his lawyers, under special administrative measures known as SAMs. Abdul Rahman asked Stewart during a prison visit in 2000 to release a statement from him to the press concerning a negotiated ceasefire between the Egyptian government and militants. The Clinton administration did not prosecute Stewart for conveying the press release, although she was admonished and prohibited from seeing her client for several months. The Bush administration, however, in April 2002, with the country baying for blood after the attacks of 9/11, decided to prosecute her for the two-year-old press release. Stewart said she never expected to be charged for releasing the press statement.
Minutes before her arrest on April 9, 2002, her husband, who later would organize a successful fight to win her a compassionate release from prison after she diagnosed with breast cancer, was outside in the stoop of her house, which she said in New York is where you go to sit on the steps in the summertime when you can't afford to go to East Hampton. She heard him in a heated conversation. I go to the door and I hear him saying, I don't see any badge. I don't see any warrant. What are you doing here anyway? She said. And assuming Ralph was being arrested, she told him to take it easy. She would have him home by lunchtime. I come around the door, and the guy looks and says, and he was clearly a cop, you know, the cheap shoes, and he says, we're not here for you. right here for her. Pointing to me, she said, I was flabbergasted. FBI agents took her from her home, and she was released later on a $500,000 bond signed by her three children. U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft came to New York in April 2002 to announce that the Justice Department had indicted Stewart, along with a paralegal and an interpreter, on grounds of materially aiding a terrorist organization. Ashcroft, that night, went to the Late Show with David Letterman to tell the nation of the indictment as part of the Bush administration's war on terror. In Stewart's trial, the government again endlessly spewed myths about Islamic terrorism. It demanded a staggering 30-year sentence. U.S. District Judge John Coitel introduced the jury more than 750 times that the photos of Osama bin Laden 2001 World Trade Center attacks shown to the jury by the government on a 10 by 12 foot screen were not relevant to the case. And Stewart was sentenced to most people's astonishment to 28 months.
After the sentencing, Stewart publicly declared that passing along the information of Abdel Rahman had been based on my understanding of what the client needed, what a lawyer was expected to do and was necessary, and that, in the same circumstances, she would do it again. Subsequently, a federal appeals court under the Barack Obama administration demanded that the district judge reconsider her sentence. She was handed a new sentence by Coitel of 10 years, so much for Barack Obama. The federal government's orchestration of fear, Stewart said, has made the country increasingly deferential to authority, especially white male authority. In the Carswell Maximum Security Prison, the women's facility where she was incarcerated, she heard numerous accounts of gross injustices endured by poor women. She frequently asked some of these women why they had not demanded a trial rather than submit to a plea deal, or why they had not stood up and proclaimed their innocence. The answer, she said, was always the same. I was afraid. I was afraid. She blames the wrecking of the legal system in part on the skyrocketing cost of law school. Law graduates, she said, have to mortgage their souls in order to go to law school. When she applied to Rutgers Law School in 1971, the school's commitment to making sure half the class was women allowed her to get a scholarship. The financial aid, along with the low state tuition, made it possible for her to attend. In later years, she operated a law practice in Greenwich Village for poor clients. Her office was above her husband's motorcycle shop on the ground floor. I could take whatever pay stub I wanted, she said. The use of corporate-backed organizations and think tanks designed to veer every public institution away from traditional liberal democratic values has dismantled our civil society, she said. The right-wing Federalist Society, after its founding in 1982, mounted a frontal assault on the legal system. Stewart, after Stanford University asked her to speak there in 2002, arrived on campus to find that the Federalist Society had pressured the university to rescind the invitation. Sympathetic students found her a place to talk, and Federalist Society members peppered her with hostile questions at the event. She was able to knock back their verbal harassments because she said she was a trained trial attorney who had been in the business for almost 30 years at the time. The federal government, by the 1980s, she said, was mopping up the remnants of radical activists, many of whom had been underground for years. She and other civil rights attorneys were able to battle on behalf of these political radicals. But by the end of the 1980s, the state had finished its hunt for underground activists, and lawyers, Stewart said, were no longer part of the game. Stewart had spent a decade in the Harlem school system as a librarian before going to law school and said working with those considered by society to be throwaway kids meant she knew the injustices of the system. The system, she said, has failed them, poor children, from beginning to end. The failure to provide elemental justice spawned by the so-called war on drugs and massive rates of incarceration, especially for poor people of color, was soon replicated within the courts in the name of the war on terror. And this corrosion has spread basic legal protections stripped first from the poor and then from Muslims has been stripped from all of us.
I asked Stewart if there had been specific moments when she lost hope in the judicial system.
Yeah.
She says, I always believed, Chris, that I could do it, she said. You know, it's like you're the last man. You're like the kicker when the opposing team is running the ball back. You're the only one between the goalpost and everything. But I was there. They had to get by me. If they couldn't get by me, they couldn't win. I have enough ego and belief in myself to say I didn't believe they could do that every time, that I could win, but that I could make a difference. I think I did make a difference for a lot of people, even people who got convicted. And the climate in the nation's courtrooms changed irrevocably after 9/11, she said. And the occasional victories she and other civil rights lawyers were able to win before then became nearly impossible to replicate. The playing field suddenly changed, and everything favored the prosecution. Certainly in federal cases, she said, there was no level playing field anymore. It was like if you were the last guy standing and you had to keep them from making the goal, you were at the six-inch line trying to do it. It was impossible to stop them. They controlled it. They controlled what the charges were. They controlled whether an adjournment would be given. They determined whether the corporation is worthy, and everybody must cooperate. And it changed into a very different system, certainly on the federal level.
In Iran trial, the government presented audio recordings of a meeting with Abdel Rahman in the prison in Rochester, Minnesota. The taping of her conversations, which before the Federal Patriot Act would have violated attorney-client privilege, is now legal. She said of the 9/11 attacks, we've never explored why. Why did this happen? Why what compelled 21 young men to give up their lives to do this thing? No, we've never. We don't want to look at that. We don't want to know why. We continue the facade that we are fair, she said, that we have this constitution we respect and we can rely on and that we can embrace. You can't do that. That's my constitutional rights, etc. When really they're a puff of smoke. They don't really exist. I asked her what she had learned from being incarcerated. I don't think I ever appreciated the unrelenting stress of being in prison, she said. That you're always waiting for something to come down. There's such arbitrary authority. Guide A says go down those stairs, use these stairs. Guide B says you can't use those stairs. You're not permitted on those stairs. And you say, but Guide A just said, I don't care what he said. This is my rule. That kind of arbitrary thing, you're always guessing. What does this guy, what does that woman want to do? Where am I? Where is this? And that's 24/7. You're always on the cusp of doing the wrong thing, of getting into trouble for something, she said. I wrote a letter for a woman in order to make a copy. I mailed it to Ralph, she went on. It was basically asking a judge to stay any decision because they were going to take all of her pension as payment for what she had done. And she wanted to get this letter in right away, so I emailed it to Ralph. And for that, I lost, I think, 3 months of commissary and email. She said, it's almost impossible to organize prisoners in this day and age to stand up, to become a unit, to say no to certain things. I found it virtually impossible to convince the women at Carswell that they should not be always thinking what happened to them was personal, she said. They should be looking at political answers, that where they ended up was not because of some personal lack or weakness, but because the political system had designated them to be there as one of the kick-arounds, as one of the not for consumption. What do you think that is, I asked. I think television has a lot to do with it, she said. There's a certain idealized life. People that are in trouble get there because they have done it to themselves. She said that many of the women incarcerated with her lack self-esteem. The women I've left behind the one real shadow of my tremendous joy of being home, she said. I can no longer even communicate with them because the conditions of my probation are that I may not associate with any felons. So I can't even write to Dear Mara what happened with your case someone who got 20 years because she sold some heroin and then a guy died a week later. And they used that murder to enhance her sentence, completely contrary to everything else we've ever learned. One of the saddest moments in prison, she said, was mail call. The names of those who had letters would be read. Some women waited for the name to be called, and it never happened. Those who did get mail or visit, she said, become more and more institutionalized. The world of the prison is the only world. The outside world does not exist for them anymore.
I'm not waiting for the working class to make the revolution, she said. I think that's a day gone by. That might have happened in the 30s. It didn't. We have to look at a new way, some new force. She said that although she is disbarred, she will continue to be a catalyst for change. She quoted Rosa Luxemburg, who said that radicals should at once alleviate human misery and do political work. Stewart said she will continue to fight for some 150 political prisoners, mostly African Americans, who have been in prison for decades because they belong to radical groups such as the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army. My other goal is not to turn my back on the women in prison, she said. They stress the importance of community. She stressed the importance. The most important thing is don't let yourself get isolated, she says. Don't feel that you are the only one in the room that thinks this way and you must be crazy or something, and they're going to get you because you're the only one. Find the other people who think like you. They're out there. There are people out there. And there are groups. There are every one of the raging grannies right up to the very serious lefties. But there is somebody out there. Make sure you're not all alone. That's the worst part of what we face these days. As long as you're with other people, you have a fighting chance and you can organize for more people.
This is pretty loveless world we live in, she concluded. We have lots of romantic love, we have lots of Sex in the City, but real love, love that is the kind that saves people and makes the world better and makes you go to bed with a smile on your face, that love is lacking greatly. You have to search for that. And this article was by Chris Hedges.
And truthdig.com. Wow.
That was quite an interview.
It was. And
thank you, Chris, for doing that and bringing that to us.
Yeah.
She's a patriot, that woman.
Well, Lynn Stewart was, and I mean, for her to be imprisoned by the Bush bastards. Just,
terrible.
And then to continue by Obama bastards.
Well, he lengthened her sentence.
Yeah. I mean,
nice guy.
What a piece of work. What a complete piece of shit he is. I mean, she's right. It just does. I mean, you got to love this woman for being who she is and standing strong. But, my God, I'll tell you.
Boy.
It really hurts to see that.
She didn't just talk the talk. She walked the walk.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, stood up.
Yeah. And she got kicked in the teeth for it.
Yeah. Well, she's right about the Constitution. There isn't any.
We're going to go to a quick music break. Then I want to come back and play you a little audio called Geoengineering and the Collapse of Earth.
Oh, that'll be an interesting one.
This must be shared. Yeah, we'll play that. I just wanted to...
You're going to play a little something? Okay. So what do you have?
Thank you.
this quickly. This is, I can't play it quickly. It's an hour long.
Part of it, anyway.
I'd like to play about 10 minutes of this going in because it's called Geoengineering and the Collapse of Earth 2014. And it says Climate Engineering, Weather Warfare, and the Collapse of Civilization.
So,
and it's a speech by a guy, and I like to.
Is this on YouTube? Will people be able to get it if they want to hear the rest of it?
You can go on YouTube. If you happen to be listening and you're on Facebook, I just shared this today with you. But you can.
You'll be able to listen to the whole thing if you want.
Yeah, and it's on YouTube. It's called Geoengineering and the Collapse of Earth 2014. Let's just listen to it.
My name is Dane Wigginton from geoengineeringwatch.org. And our purpose of our site is to expose the issue of global climate engineering, otherwise termed as geoengineering. We are virtually under assault right now. It's not alarmism. It's not exaggeration. This type of weather modification puts out chemicals and toxins, some known, some not known. Many people who try to debate this issue, if they ask you why they should believe this is going on, we have film of it happening, end of the argument. That's it. There's no debate, no discussion. This is not speculation. When we have films that we can clearly see are spraying, there's no denying that jet is spraying, period. We have interior films, interior footage, which I'll show in a moment. But the bottom line is that's not a condensation trail. Any notion that it is simply denial or complete ignorance. So this is, you can even see on this jet, each side of the plane, the plumes are different lengths, which means the nozzles are not aligned perfectly. You see a different composition in the trail, also indicative of different materials being expelled from different portions of the aircraft. So again, this amounts to weather warfare, period. The U.S. has historically engaged in weather warfare around the globe. This is historical fact. We have data going back to Vietnam, 1968, Project Popeye, 1976, UN passed resolutions forbidding weather modification in wartime. So again, this is not speculation. We live in a society that's been trained to shut down when they hear the word conspiracy theory. They've been conditioned pretty well. But the bottom line is this is the issue that can't be ignored any longer. People can ignore Kennedy. People can ignore false flag events like Vietnam and even whatever happened on 9/11. But this issue can't be ignored. When in the North State, for example, we turn on our water faucets and nothing comes out, that's the end of the road. This is very recent. This is from 2 days ago. Al Gore. Use of geoengineering to head up climate change disaster is insane. So although we don't have an admission that's going on, it's getting closer by the day. And it looks like Al Gore is trying to now distance himself from these programs that he has not admitted to yet. This is important media. We'll be seeing more of this in the coming weeks. One interior shot there. Again, we can't know from the variants of different planes the different configurations of spray apparatus. This is an ongoing experiment. There's likely many different configurations. We see aircraft trails that have different color compositions. So this is an ongoing experiment of which we are all a part, like it or not. Another interior, high-pressure tanks. When this image was posted, the sites that initially posted it, a couple of them were taken down. This image appeared to be tried to be taken off the net as quickly as possible, but too many people downloaded it. It's out there now. More configurations. Obviously, there's a whole lot of planes with a whole lot of tanks doing a whole lot of something. So this kind of footage should not be ignored. Clearly, these are what would appear to be passenger planes, most of them with windows. So there appear to be many different types of aircrafts involved in the spraying activities. This is what we have. Again, global geoengineering, the ever-changing experiment, and we are, again, part of that experiment. Russian scholar warns of secret U.S. climate change weapon. We have Russia engaged in this as well. We also have China. And this is one of the reasons why it's so hard to get any sort of mainstream coverage, because the big players are all involved up to their eyeballs. So that's one of the reasons the media coverage is so sparse, but it's coming. What do weather weapons do? They wreak havoc in countries without anybody knowing they're even under assault. In the case of floods, droughts, all of this is a form of weather weaponry and weather warfare. And there's no arguing that we are all a part of weather warfare when our climate is being impacted the way it is right now. Again, countries around the globe, this sort of impact, nobody would recognize as being an assault. And that's what's so prized about weather warfare for the powers that be. Nobody even knows they're being attacked.
Okay.
Bridges, infrastructure, wiped out. You can literally bring a country to its knees. You can bring a state to its knees as well, especially a state that doesn't seem to want to conform too much with the federal government. You can drought them out completely. And that's exactly what's happening to California right now. This sort of drought in Africa has been used for decades. We know these programs have been going on, and their impact in Africa appears to be directly related to bringing countries to their knees and opening up the door for U.S. occupation. You have U.S. boots on the ground in about 156 countries around the globe. Not singling out the U.S. because other countries, again, as I said, are at this as well. Empty reservoirs. This is where California is headed today. I think we all know that. If we reach the end of this year without significant rainfall, we will be in free fall into a cataclysm that's never before been recorded. Our forests are going up in flames. As geoengineering impacts the system from top to bottom, it starts to feed itself. As you cut off the moisture for boreal forests, which are the lungs of the planet, the terrestrial lungs of the planet, and they begin to burn, that feeds into the entire climate cycle and begins to tilt it even further off scale. So this is a non-linear equation. Once it starts to tilt, it tilts faster and faster. These sorts of clouds historically have not been well recorded. Now they are. This sort of sky that many have become accustomed to and think is somehow normal is anything but. This is an aerosol coverage that all of you seem to have seen before. And many people have begun to accept this as being natural, but it takes a lot of material to block the sun to that degree, and all that material is settling down on all of us. We're all breathing it in. Anybody who thinks that's commercial traffic is in a different reality. Somebody certainly lost their way up there. Another scene looks like something from another planet. Again, this is something that people, it's come on so slowly that many accept this as being normal and natural when it's...
This is very difficult to listen to, if I not see, because he's showing all the chemtrail patterns and all the unusual cloud patterns that are caused by the geoengineering. And I can't emphasize more than to go to this YouTube
site.
It's called Geoengineering and the Collapse of Earth 2014. Okay. And please go to that. I'm going to later, I haven't yet, but later I will be putting it up on my website called lasteelshow.org, and you'll be able to see it. I'll be doing that later after the show in about 15 minutes. But anyway, let us go on.
That was very, very, very good.
Yeah, that was a little more. But,
which isn't it interesting how Al Gore does a little dance to get himself out of stuff?
Yeah. Learned something today that was really interesting. Actually, we can go to this right after. But what this guy was saying about this film was saying about the drought
in California.
We now have this is what's happening in California.
Well, they just got some rain recently.
Well, California governor will withhold water from local farms, from local farms this spring due to severe drought.
Wow.
Yeah, this is from naturalnews.com. As an unprecedented drought in California worsens, Governor Jerry Brown's administration has decided to take a radical measure by withholding water for many of the state's farmers come spring planting season.
Oh, boy.
As reports by the New York Times, the decision is impactful and will affect millions. Responding to one of the worst droughts in California history, state officials announced on Friday they would cut off the water to local agencies serving 25 million residents and about 750,000 acres of farmland. 25 million residents. Okay. Cut off the water supply.
Well, how do they decide who those 25 million are?
Yeah, but what? 25 million. You know, there's only 20. I think there's 38 million in the entire state. Right?
With no end in sight.
for the dry spell and reservoirs at historic lows. Mark Cohen, director of California Department of Water Resources, said his agency needed to preserve a little water remain so that it could be used as wisely as possible. Worst drought in the last 100 years. Reports say it will be the first time in 54-year history of the state water project that allocations of water to all of the public agencies it serves are being cut to zero, and the decision is expected to force 20 local water agencies to look elsewhere for water. Many reportedly have other sources on which they can draw, like local reservoirs and groundwater. That said, the drought has taken its toll on those supplies as well, Times reported. Some cities, for example, especially in the eastern San Francisco Bay Area, depend almost entirely on the state water project, according to Corwin. We always keep a basic human health and safety as highest priority, he said. We'll try to meet those needs as best we can. And meanwhile, the Metropolitan Water District, serving much of the state's southernmost regions, receives some 30% of its water from the state water project. Most farmers served in the region are in Kern County, located in the southern end of the Central Valley. The area is a major source of carrots. Our action is indeed to keep as much of the remaining water supply upstream in reservoirs, Frank told the Times, so we have it available for the warm period in the summer and fall.
The driest year on recent record in the state occurred last year, and in January, which is normally one of the wettest months, almost no precipitation fell. Governor Brown declared a drought emergency for the state last month, and the Times said, despite a little moisture in a few parts of the state recently, the drought news has only worsened in a couple of weeks since he made his announcement. This is the most serious drought we've faced in modern times, said Felicia Marcus, chairwoman of the State Water Reserve Control Board, as reported by the Associated Press. We need to conserve what little we have to use later in the year, or even in future years. Currently, state water reservoir levels are lower than they were in 1977, which was the last time the state went through such a major drought. And this year, California's snowpack is only 12% of what it is normal for this time of the year. Worse, 17 rural communities are in danger of completely running out of water in just a few more months.
My action is a stark reminder that California's drought is a real problem, said in the statement. We're taking every possible step to prepare the state for the continuing dry conditions we face. Corin went on to say that there is not enough water to meet the needs of farmers, cities, and conservation efforts intended to stave off dwindling populations of salmon and other fish in Northern California. Brown has called on state residents and businesses to cut back water usage by 20%, after that Francisco Chronicle reported. Good Lord.
Wow.
Yeah. And the problem...
That's really scary.
Well, the problem, too, is this damn stuff is caused by geoengineering, and we know it. Anyway.
What did California do that they're punishing those residents?
I don't know. Well...
He alluded to the fact in that audio piece that they were being punished
for
something.
Well, one of the reasons I can see, and I think this is obvious, is they're destroying the land. Okay.
Maybe there are a lot of private farmers out there.
A lot of small farmers, but they're destroying the private farms. They're destroying the farmland. Okay, so the corporate guys can buy them up.
Can go in there and just.
And exactly. So they want to destroy the little farmers. That's obvious what's happening.
I thought most of the land out there was already owned by big farmers,
no,
but maybe not.
Northern California.
All wine country. And
no, the big cannabis country.
Maybe that's what they want.
They want to grow most of the cannabis.
They want that so that they can grow it all.
Sure, but what they're doing is just basically destroying California. California is a major breadbasket, a major producer of vegetables, major producer of wines, major producer of everything edible, and it's being threatened. Let's see. Lyme disease has been controversial for some years, but this is amazing. CBD, or hemp oil, as a cannabidiol. Natural Lyme disease has been controversial for some years. Many medical practitioners misdiagnose it, while several think that it's mental.
That's true. I've heard that.
With Lyme disease, there are so many symptoms, so many debilitating, agonizing manifestations, that it's often misdiagnosed as multiple sclerosis, chronic fatigue, or a mental issue.
Lupus.
Now, Lyme disease is caused by a spirochetal bacteria of the Borrelia genus. Spirochetes are composed of about 40% DNA and have double membrane envelopes that make them difficult to trace and kill. They're apparently able to hide in deep tissue and change shapes to disguise their identities. They're somewhat similar to the bacteria behind syphilis, as Lyme disease affects the nervous system and the brain also. Going through the medical symptoms that with
system.
Lyme disease, system with Lyme disease is like being a bale in an old-fashioned pinball, an old-fashioned pinball game machine. Being on antibiotics forever is risking serious adverse effects, or at least reducing one's immunity to invite all sorts of other complications. All this without a complete cure. But now there is a considerable hope with cannabis.
Isn't that wonderful?
Lyme successes.
There are two levels of handling Lyme with cannabis. Managing symptoms well by smoking marijuana, or completely reversing the disease with cannabis oil. Not many are aware of cannabis oil pioneered by Rick Simpson a few years ago. Rick has said that most of the healing qualities of cannabis are lost in the smoke. Alexis, diagnosed with late-stage Lyme disease, is an example of someone handling symptoms without pharmaceuticals by smoking marijuana. She was on antibiotics long enough for her gastrointestinal tract to be damaged and to be hospitalized with hemorrhagic colitis. She was taken off antibiotics and put on several strong pain prescriptions that were barely effective while putting her into a lower emotional state. Then she tried smoking marijuana. That routine handled most of her nausea, enabled her to eat well enough to avoid wasting away, and helped her sleep better and eased her pain while elevating her mood. She maintains that marijuana has been the best thing for her Lyme disease. Alexis wrote, "In hospital, I have needed to have morphine or lorazepam through an IV to accomplish what smoking 2 grams of cannabis does on the comfort of my couch. In a fraction of time, actually, but Alexis is looking for a long-term solution. Some have discovered the solution using cannabis oil for Lyme disease. Cannabis oil is a highly concentrated substance that extracted and reduced from large amounts of cannabis with a good balance of THC and other cannabinoids. It has become increasingly available in states that allow medical marijuana, but it's also available underground if you search on the internet. This is the stuff that has been curing cancer lately."
Shelley White's Lyme disease was so debilitating that she had endured at least 10 seizures daily for a year and a half. She began smoking marijuana from a pipe and then switched to inhaling it through a vaporizer. Just from that, her seizures have stopped. And then she decided to go to the next level of using cannabis oil. After a month of the oil, she was able to return to work and school. And at the time of writing her story, she was happy to announce that she could now move out and live on her own and enjoy a normal social life. An internet radio show called High Noon interviewed a couple of Lyme disease victims who had been using cannabis oil successfully. Pamela Bailey and Lisa Sykes. Listen via the link at Source. Says Lymies should look into cannabis since it handles so many ailments associated with Lyme disease. All right.
Yeah, that's not wonderful.
Yeah, you can go to Sources here. Collective-evolution.com. Blog Talk Radio. I don't know if she's on that.
Maybe.
420times.com and science.naturalnews.com. So anyway.
The author, Paul Fasser, is dedicated to warning others about the current corruption of food and medicine and guiding others toward a direction for better health with no restrictions on health and on health freedom.
You can visit his blog at Health Haven, or rather Health Maven, Health Maven, Health, M-A-V-E-N, .blogspot.com. Okay. Check that one out, folks.
Kind of interesting, huh?
Yeah, I thought that was
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
To know that there are so many good cures out there for people.
It is.
There's so much physical suffering.
Yeah.
People are suffering so much, unnecessarily, really.
Yeah.
And there's so much good stuff out there that can prevent that.
Get ready for a mass exodus of online businesses.
Out of California, and here's why. Okay.
Amazon tax bill passed the state.
Well, we have a tax bill here, too. Oh, they put a warehouse there. The state of California could collect more than $1 billion a year by taxing Amazon and other online retailers if a bill approved by the assembly becomes law. Yeah, that's all that is.
This is in May. This is 2 years ago when this whole thing happened. That's a day article. Yeah, it is an old article. But what's interesting to note, folks, is that amazing.
We only have two more minutes.
Here's another one we'll go to. This is a scientist. DNA from genetically modified crops can be transferred to humans who eat them.
Well, no kidding.
Yeah. And what else we got here?
Frankencorn.
You know what?
Probably two more.
But you can get that from collective-evolution.com. But this is kind of an important one. This isn't too long. Chemicals as nutrients in USDA organic infant formula. All right.
Chemicals as nutrients?
Yeah.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, the USDA says it. It is time to shed some long overdue light on serious and avoidable chemical exposure facing the majority of infants today. Due to the fact that only 11% of newborns in the U.S. are exclusively breastfed during their first 6 months of life, it is safe to say that most newborns today are exposed to the ingredients found in infant formula. Owing to the fact that infant formula is being used during the first year of life, which is the most critical development period of human life cycle, it behooves us to make sure that what we are feeding them is truly nourishing, and at the very least, not harming them, correct? So, what exactly is being put into infant formula millions believe is the closest facsimile to human breast milk available? We will take a more forgiving approach and avoid the more obviously lower quality mass marketing infant formula brands, which are genetically modified products and high fructose corn syrup, to name but a few obvious red flags. Instead, we look to the so-called organic product, like Earth Best Organic Infant Formula, as an assumption. Here is what is earthy organic. And as the label proud displays, produced without the use of potentially harmful pesticides. Did you get that, by the way? Potentially harmful pesticides. Because, you know, some pesticides are not actually harmful to infants, right? This strange qualification will take on a clearer, far more chilling meaning in just a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my
I'll look
God.
At the ingredients.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So, anyway. Guys, don't eat this stuff. Warning, milk contains soy. And milk and soy, good manufacturing practices are used to prevent it. Yeah,
right. Well, we come right to the
Earth's Best Organic. Forget about it, okay? Earth's Best Organic is not good.
Okay. All right. So
you can get to this article by going to greenmedinfo.com. Okay.
All right. And we've come right to the end of our show, so thank you for listening. Thanks for being with us. And stay tuned for our show tomorrow night.
Yeah, we have some
union issues. We'll have some union news.
Environmental stuff and stuff. And all talking about different protests and different things.
We look forward to having you in our audience.
Around the world.
Have a great night, folks. Good night.